It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be looking at how technology is changing our workplaces. Our guest says some jobs will be eliminated, but other opportunities will be created. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, we revisit the mining issue in northern Wisconsin. Our next guest says a mine in northern Wisconsin is essential to address the unemployment issues there, and it's time for our elected leaders to follow through with it and get started creating jobs.
John Sendra joins us now. He's a retired businessman. He ran for assembly in 2012. John, thanks for joining us on Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. I'd like to, of course, chime in with my voice on pro-mining issues. So if you have questions, fire away, or if I have a diatribe that I could...
You have a prepared diatribe. Wonderful. No, let's start with make the case. Why do we need an iron mine here in Wisconsin?
Well, first and foremost, it is the most abundant resource we have in northern Wisconsin. As you know, maybe you're not familiar with northern Wisconsin. Maybe the rest of the state needs to know that we have very few opportunities up here. I used to own a restaurant before I retired, and this was the type of jobs that we offered up here, mostly tourist-based. And those jobs pay typically about minimum wage or slightly above. Not the type of jobs that you would want to raise a family on. Virtually impossible to send your kids to college, to buy homes, et cetera, et cetera. Mining, as an industry, is one of the highest paid types of jobs that you can get. Just laborers alone and, heavy machine operators and so on will make in the neighborhood of $82,000 fully benefited per year. These are family-sustaining jobs. Do we need them up here? Most certainly. We have no other alternatives. We have 20 to 25% of all the iron ore in the United States right here in Iron County and Ashland counties. So you could see why we want to develop mining. And by the way, that's our heritage. If you look at the Wisconsin flag, that's a miner on there.
Now, what is the economy like right now without a mine in the area you live in?
Great question. As of the end of May 2013, unemployment in Iron County was 14.3%, and Ashland was 11.2%. I think that's absolutely disgraceful. Our senator from Poplar is not a pro-mining guy. You would think he comes from the party of the people for jobs, but yet he was anti-mining. This is the type of job, you heard the numbers I said, $82,000 a year fully benefited. But there could be anywhere from 700 to 1,200 jobs paying that kind of income. There would be an economic renaissance here in the North Woods if we had that many jobs paying that much money. We're estimating the taxes alone, and I quote the North Star Economics Report that cited that our tax base in Iron County would receive $17 to $18.5 million annually from the mining, the amount of business that it would generate. Statewide, it would the ripple effect would cause with all the foundries and all the other mining-related companies that we have, the machine manufacturers, that would represent in the neighborhood of $660 million annually to our state.
One critique that gets brought up about mines around the world is that eventually the ore runs out, or at least the financially viable ore runs out, whether that's in 10 years or 30 years or 40 years. And the jobs go away. It's not a long-term strategy for keeping jobs around. What do you say to that?
Again, I'll refer to the North Star Economic Report. It says they're estimating 25 minimum, as long as 100 years. That's the amount of ore. As I said earlier, 20 to 25% of all the ore in the United States is right up here in the Pinokies. And I can cite you an example of what that means. I told you about the dollars, but there was a mine in Ladysmith. It ran for 4.5 years. And that mine generated, I guess there were 75 jobs. From that, an additional ripple effect, 600 jobs were created. They enjoyed prosperity from 1993 to 97. They enjoyed that until we had our crash in 2008. This is the type of thing that mining can encourage. Don't forget, there's going to be a lot of restaurants, there's going to be a lot of motels, there's going to be a lot of car dealerships, appliance dealerships and manufacturers that will thrive in an economy that has this kind of income. So it may be short-term, depending on your definition, but there have been a lot of companies that have gone in and out of business over the history of our country. So I'll take 25 to 35 years first phase and maybe another 65 any old time.
And the biggest worry of mine critics seems to hinge on the environment, anywhere from people saying we don't want the iron mine at all because we're concerned about the environmental impact, to some who say we could take the mine as long as we have very strong environmental safeguards in place.
Well, let me remind you, there are 12 government agencies, and I can probably name them if I try real hard, but we have the EPA, we have Army Corps of Engineers, we have local DNRs, we have county agencies, we have all kinds of, there's 12 of them. But the point very simply is this. We're talking about ferrous mining, and people need to understand what this is. Ferrous mining is more like surface mining. It's like a sand pit or gravel pit. For those of you in counties where you have sand or gravel pits, please remember, this is this is not very polluting, or it's low-impact polluting. Specifically, the mine in the Pinokis, what will happen is this. excuse me. They haven't the ferrous mining creates very little sulfides. And this is one of the things that the environmental fringe always tries to bring up. They make it sound like if it's acid mining. It's not. Surface mining creates very little sulfides. And if there are, they can be neutralized, or as they say in the mining industry, engineered out with things like limestone, of all things. You can neutralize sulfides with limestone. This is done naturally. And again, it doesn't occur very often in surface mining. Secondly, the water pollution that they always refer to, the process is kind of new today. There's a whole new technology. Please remember, this is not 1913, it's 2013. They do have a 22-mile pipeline scheduled to be put in from Ironwood, Michigan, an old mine shaft where there are water and the cities where there is water, and the cities use that for their own water supply. They have a 25% capacity usage right now, and the other 75% goes unused. So they've come up with a plan. It's called a self-enclosed water management system. It's like a car wash. They use the water, they clean it, and they reuse it. And this is what they'll do at the mining site. So the potential for pollution is minimalized drastically. I think you have to look for other motivations. Your arguments are there. They've been there for a long time. The environmental crowd has, proposed these potential problems for a long time. But I don't think they're really serious about it. Only one case in point. They keep citing the Bad River in their rice beds. My only question is, there has been some pollution earlier this year that was cited by the EPA. None of the anti-mining crowd wants to tackle that issue, and they're strangely silent about this. I find that kind of funny. There is a potential maybe in mining. It might be a small potential, but yet they're up in arms, and then you have a very heinous pollution that's going on right now, and they do nothing about it. So
looking ahead, there's obviously a lot of passion over this issue, a lot of protests going on right now. Some of the legislators who are more in the middle ground on the issue are actually looking at trying to get laws to keep public access away from some of the exploratory mining sites. Sure. Where do you see it going over the next couple months?
Well, what I see is the anti-mining crowd, and that includes some of our legislators. I think you probably read in some of the periodicals around Madison. We get them in all the newspapers up here that Senator Joe Cullen and Schultz are going to be up here again, yet again, visiting the mining site. They've been here before SB1 was in place, the mining law, and they'll come up again, and for gosh knows what reason. They can't vote no against it one more time because it is now law. They're coming up here for typical reasons to show support for the anti-mining crowd and to get in the way of this thing to proceed. I think it's disgusting. We need jobs up here desperately, and when our own senator is against mining for no good reason, absolutely no good reason, I think that's disgraceful.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That was John Sendra. He's a retired businessman. He has run for the assembly in one of the districts up there, and this is an issue we're going to keep covering as it develops.
Coming up next, it's a look at how technology is changing the workplace and how it could affect you. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time.
Well, technology is changing everything, how we communicate, how we eat, how we travel, and it's changing the workplace. Some jobs are being eliminated because of technology, but in some cases, new opportunities are being created.
Here to talk about this with us is Tracy Weiland-Agenti, a career expert and visiting scholar at Stanford University, and we'll be looking for your calls as well. How has technology changed your job or your workplace? Has your job disappeared because of technology, or maybe some new technologies have created a job for you? Do you have questions about technology and work? If so, give us a call and join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also drop us an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
I wanted to go back in history because while I was thinking about this, I was remembering that famous story of John Henry, the steel-driving man, and his race against the steel hammer and all of that. And ultimately, of course, he was unsuccessful. But it's a reminder that technology in the workplace and changes that it brings to it are nothing new.
You know, that's amazing that you were just talking about that story because I was just conversing with someone on that. And in that case, he was competing with technology, against technology rather than competing with technology. And I think in today's environment, we need to think about how we can use technology to our advantage and not view it as a disadvantage.
Boy, that's a tough one, though, isn't it? Because I think most people do take that view that we're going to get this new piece of technology and it means that my work is going to go away or it's going to change it in some radical fashion.
Well, if you look at technology, or, you know, in the workplace, it definitely can make us more efficient, productive, and even add precision, as in surgery, and I talk to surgeons who use augmented virtual reality. But just think about in your day-to-day life, you're using probably some sort of smartphone or iPhone or iPad, and you probably saw, oh, the swipe technology is really easy, much easier than me maybe sitting at a computer. So I think a lot of us intuitively are using technology day to day and seeing how it can make our lives easier.
So let's talk about some specific places where technology is really making change. Is there an industry you can point to and say this is totally different than it was 20 years ago, 10 years ago?
Well, I think, you know, everyone thinks of manufacturing, and I think that industry has been totally turned on its head with technology. I mean, I started my career in manufacturing, and there were people on the line, and then we went through the phase of outsourcing. But if you look at making a car today, 90% of cars are made actually through robotics. And even the prototyping industry that I participated in has been replaced by 3D printing. In fact, you can go, and I've gone to the local Microsoft stores, and they have 3D printers so you can make things like toys. So I think that industry is one that's totally changed. I think the automotive industry obviously has changed. If you think about your car, it's really a mobile device, right? A computer modal device on wheels. Many of us used to change our oil. A lot of us can't even do that anymore. In fact, General Motors has a call center for people like you and me who have a fancy car and we don't know how to start it anymore, or how to use the GPS because cars have become so saturated with very good technology, interesting technology, but something that we all have to adapt to. So those are two examples.
And as I understand it, the technology that's in use in the workplace also comes with a price in terms of the demands it places on workers. I mean, you've got to be on your game to deal with some of this technology.
Well, I think that workers need to remember that continuous learning is part of the job as much as it is doing your job. So as the work environment, as the consumer changes, right, that changes the way that firms change, and they will adopt technology, and then you need to learn how to use modern-day tools, just like you learned to use the tools when you first started. I think most employees get excited about using technology once they get over perhaps the initial fear, but a lot of it has to do with proper training, integration, and showing how practical it can be or efficient it can be for people. I mean, let's face it, many of us use those hand calculators, and we're relieved that we can, you know, use Excel right, which is a spreadsheet, and now we can even automate it. So there's a lot of benefits from using these technologies.
Now, I read an interview with you someplace where you predicted that by 2020, 75% of the jobs out there are going to have a technical component, a technology component that is going to be a major part of that job. Where did you get that prediction from, and how quick a change is that in terms of where we are now?
Absolutely. When you think about it, right, so I grew up in a classical world, right? So let's just go back to that time where a high school degree, or if you went to college, a liberal arts degree was just enough for any type of classical job. Most people actually got jobs with ease. And then as it's changed, now we are graduating students into a very technology-oriented world where the jobs have increased, become more complex, and have a technology component to them. So it's very difficult today to say, okay, I can take my general background and move into a technology-enriched environment. And so we just need to change with those times and make sure that we are always employable in a modern day.
Boy, that sounds tough. I mean, I have to tell you, for a certain segment of the population, that is going to be really difficult, and I'm not sure where you would draw that line. It seems that there are going to be a lot of younger folks who are going to be ready for this type of change, but maybe older people, and I don't know where you draw that line in terms of someone who's been in the workforce for 10 or 20 or 30 years. Is there a point when it gets more difficult in your experience?
Well, what I'm seeing is that people are developing what I would call like hybrid approaches to their jobs. They are integrating technology naturally into their position. You think about it, if you're in marketing and you had a traditional marketing background, many marketing people today are integrating social media into their jobs and are learning how to use social media. You're combining the subject matter expertise with the new technologies. Same thing with accounting. Most accountants probably started off, as they tell me, with paper and pencil. But today they have been able to integrate different types of software to help them automate the process. And many say it's much easier. It improves. Same thing with medicine. Talked to many physicians who have done all surgeries or all medical procedures manually. And now they have technology such as robotics, augmented virtual reality, prosthetics, that they can actually integrate and use these technologies to advance their field. So it isn't really black or white. It's really gray, where you can say, okay, I have a subject matter expertise, and how can I integrate the technology and use it to make my job easier for me and more productive?
And, we've been focusing a lot on what some people might perceive as negatives, but you point out that there are going to be new jobs that come about as a result of new technology, new opportunities.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we go back to the manufacturing example, there are opportunities through robotics and automation. In fact, many are saying, gee, the whole manufacturing industry may take a turn back to the United States because you have robotics now that are made in the U.S. and that are more efficient than the labor overseas. I think there's opportunities, of course, in healthcare. I mean, if you think about, you probably see these videos like I do, is the exoskeleton actually are robotic legs that can enable people to walk. 3D, you can make, using 3D printing, ears that can be help people, right, with body parts that are missing. I mean, there's so many opportunities created through technology.
So if everything that we've been talking about sounds like Greek to a listener, how can they prepare themselves for this change that's already underway?
Yeah, so I do get asked often for a prescription for continued employability in a technology-based world. And, number one, I think all of us need to keep on top of industry trends. And if you're in a field, you naturally do that. So I think it's important, though, to say, okay, where is my field going? If I am in manufacturing, what are some of the trends that are coming down, and are there opportunities, really, for me to learn about it? Two is learn some of the complementary technology industries. Many times firms will offer classes and training to its employees on new databases, new technologies for free. And I think employees can say, okay, I should really take advantage of that. Also, you know, lateral moves in jobs. A lot of us were programmed to stay in one job forever. That's how it was, you know, in the past. Today, many companies are looking for people who pursue lateral moves and build their own skill sets and experience. Number four is
and
what
I'm
gonna I
have
do.
To, I'm going to ask you to hold number four till after the news because we're almost out of time. Talking to Tracy Weiland-Agenti right now, career expert and visiting scholar, about how technology is changing work.
And we want to hear from you with your story. How has technology changed your job? Made it easier, harder? Did it put you out of work? Or do you work in some kind of new technology industry? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking about the use of technology in the workplace and how it's changing where we work and how work works for us. We're being joined this half hour by Tracy Weiland-Agenti, a career expert and visiting scholar at Stanford University.
And we're hoping you can put a face and a voice to the changes that are going on. How has your workplace changed in the last 5 or 10 or 15 years thanks to technology? Did you retire maybe a little earlier than you would have rather than adapt to a new technology? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Tracy Weiland-Agenti, before the break, we were talking about how people can prepare themselves and sort of make themselves ready for some of these changes. Talked about the idea of looking for opportunities at where you work now, complementary training, the idea of lateral moves. And then I interrupted you rather rudely, I thought, on point number 4.
Oh, no, not at all. So I'll just give you the rest of the points. Is something which I have done over the years and continue to do is I look to the major providers, Microsoft, Apple, AT&T, Verizon, and I go to their free seminars and actually have one-on-one consulting. Microsoft, for example, has a great program in their stores for $99 for 52 hours of one-on-one consulting to make sure that I keep up on the technology. But things that my parents do is they go to adult ed. Of course, they're very intrigued with technology, particularly if it involves grandchildren. And many of my colleagues join meetup groups. And meetup is, you know, people meet on a variety of things, for restaurants and wine tasting to actually learning technologies. So I think there's a lot of opportunities. You know, I think if people think about something that they would enjoy doing that's practical for them, you know, whether it's filing your recipes or tracking your, you know, your running or your triathlon, you'll see that technology is actually a language and one that is transferable.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned your parents and the idea that one of the reasons they're attracted to technology is because they are grandparents. And if they want to communicate with their grandchildren, that's how they have to do it. That whole idea of incentive, whether it's in grandparenting or in the workplace, is key to this whole thing, I think.
Absolutely. I think you learn anything in life if it has more practicality for whatever you're doing day to day. You know, many people resisted going to the ATM until one day they needed cash on a Sunday and the bank was closed. And then they realized, oh, this is an opportunity and it isn't so hard to learn once you get over the intimidation of sliding the card in. And now most people don't even think about going to an ATM as a barrier. Same thing with the airline industry, that, oh, you know, the thought of going and using electronic tickets, well, now everyone's jumping on board to get the mobile ticket on their smartphones so they can avoid the long line at the airport. So I think it's once people see the practical use of technology, get over the hump of how to use it, and usually that's by either, you know, someone supporting them or helping them through that first step, then they start to see the benefits and it becomes pretty natural and integrated into the life.
So if you are not tech savvy right now and you're listening to this program, you're working in a workplace where you don't really see that technical change, but you also don't see that job hanging around for much longer. What are your options? If you've never really had to deal with this before, if you've been out there for a long time, how do you get started at thinking about your situation and trying to chart a course?
Absolutely. And that is some of actually my current research is on career and career development. I think a lot of people don't realize or not really engaging in the fact that they're living much longer, right? There's lots of Prudential Insurance is doing a whole campaign about how people today will live to 100, babies born today will live to 120. That changes your work life dramatically. If you think about it, you may have started work at 20. You may be working 50 years now, but in your mind, you thought you would only be working 20 or 30 years. And the technologies that you're using today, you might be using Google, Apple, and Facebook, have actually are under 12 years old, some even, you know, younger like Twitter. So the acceleration of technology can change your workplace much faster. So I do feel today that people have to start to plan out their careers much more than in the past. For a few reasons. One, there aren't as many jobs available. And then number two, the jobs that are available are much more complex. There are areas that we haven't even seen or heard of yet. So it takes a lot more planning.
So if someone were to be thinking about an area that is really ripe for technology and a place where you could really make a mark, is there a certain industry, a certain field that you would point them to, or is any place good right now? Do you really need to kind of think about following your passion?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of practicality and passion, right? And, you know, we have to make money and we have to have something to do. But, of course, what we'd like to do is like what we do. So that's why career planning comes, you know, as important. Healthcare, obviously, is a big area that a lot of people are anticipating growth. And healthcare is one of the fastest users and adopters of technology, depending on what part of healthcare you're in. There's always roles for people. I love the healthcare industry because it's very flexible. You can get a role with under, you know, 2 years of college. You can get a role up to a medical doctor, right? We have so many different fields there, so I think it's very flexible. Retail is another high-growth area, and there's, you know, and if you want to also tag on to that, the hospitality industry is quite interesting. And if you're future-forward thinking, some of the areas that I get excited about is the, you know, in tourism, in, you know, whether it's in space or underwater, in retail, the whole area of wearable technologies, right, in the Nike bands to the Twitter dresses. So I think there's a lot of exciting things out there, but each of us have to say, okay, where's my passion, my interest? What do I need to do? What do I need to learn to participate in some of these new exciting areas?
And, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about, but has sort of been running throughout this conversation, is the speed at things at which things move right now. And if I learn something today and I'm on the cutting edge, in about 3 months, I'm going to be at the back of the pack somewhere. And that, to me, that constant churn of having to keep up all the time seems very, very daunting for a lot of people.
Yes, and I think it's part of your planning on your field. I mean, you know, as you know, a medical doctor and accountant have to keep up on their industry, right, because they're dealing either with laws or with people. And in the same way, IT or information technology experts also need to keep up on their field. So I think you have to look at your industry and say, okay, what kind of job do I want? And, you know, how can I plan my career? And what is my learning curve and path given the career that I pick? You know, I kind of view it as in three groups, if I could. There's, you know, there will be the group that will create the technology, the engineers, the science. I actually am not in that group. I wasn't brought up or have that kind of expertise, but that there's a group there. They create the patents and the new widgets and gadgets. And then there's a group that I put myself in, and I think a lot of people in, who learn how to use the technology to do something with it, whether it's marketing, sales, distribution, manufacturing. And we can make a living in our industry, our subject matter expertise, with the technology. And then I think there would be another group that operates the technology, people who maybe don't know what to do with the technology or how to create the technology, but they learn how to operate the technology. And that can be technicians, whether in the healthcare industry or in manufacturing, operators. And all of these groups can make a living. I think it's up to you to really decide you know, how do I want to make my living, and how much do I want to learn, and how much do I really want to spearhead in my area or not, you know? And I think any career can find a balance in what they want to do.
Boy, it sounds like there aren't a lot of dull moments ahead.
No, I actually think it's very exciting. If you think about, I mean, years ago, you know, what life was like, I think it's far more exciting today. And every generation will say, you know, oh, gosh, that printing press destroyed the book. And it really didn't destroy the book. And the radio destroyed the printing press, right? Or the TV destroyed the radio. And, you know, each generation reflects on, oh, it's destroying things, and then realizes, oh, life got really much more exciting now that we have all of these technologies at our disposal.
Well, Tracy Weiland-Agenti, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been great having you. Tracy Weiland-Agenti has been with us, a career expert and visiting scholar at Stanford University.
Coming up next, we're going to talk about how we say certain words like pecan or pecan. I can barely do it. Aunt or aunt, mayonnaise or mayonnaise. How do we pronounce them differently around the country based on where we are? I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, or is that Purcell? And this is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time.
Now, Gene, pecan or pecan pie?
It's pecan pie.
Soda, I mean, soda or pop?
It's always been pop. It will always be pop.
It was pop when I grew up in Michigan. It's soda now, and my relatives make fun of me. Well, a statistician at North Carolina State University came up with some maps that show what words we say and how we pronounce them based on where we live in the United States. Now, some maps show age-old distinctions like soda versus pop and pecan versus pecan. I have to think about it before I say it.
Tom Purnell joins us now to talk about the way we pronounce things. He's an associate professor of English at UW-Madison. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to talk a little bit about this map. Apparently, it's been around for a while, and the premise behind it is we can click on the map and we can see how people pronounce things in a regional basis.
Correct. The maps were developed out of a questionnaire in 2003 by Professor Vox, who was at Harvard at the time. He's now at Cambridge, and he developed these maps asking a general questionnaire of different types of questions and sort of trying to provide a glimpse of what the U.S. is doing with speech.
And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say what's new about the maps now, even though they're 10 years old, is that they provide a different way of looking at them. Before, they were just data points, and now it's more of this sort of glossing and sort of showing gradient patterns, which is actually a better way of looking at language.
Now, what are some of the most divisive words in the United States?
Well, in the United States, there's some that are sort of regional that will mark you out. Mm-hmm. Some of them have to do, say, with your intonation pattern. So like umbrella or Thanksgiving, those mark you out as a Southerner. Mm-hmm. There's others that mark you out as an upper Midwesterner. So the word for bag and big will mark you out that way. There's some other words that are more general that have a lot of different patterns, which are like the Mary.
I'll talk about Mary a little bit.
Sure. So that one we often use for introductory students to try and demonstrate to them that maybe the things that they assume, the pronunciation that they assume, is one that other people don't use. So there's a lot of pockets for that particular word.
It's so interesting to hear us talking about these regional dialects because there's this perception that the whole country is getting more homogenous in terms of the use of its language, that we're all starting to sound the same. Is there any truth to that, or are there still a lot of differences out there?
The answer to that is actually yes. There are differences, but at the same time, we are becoming the same. So when it comes around to standardization and education, so students going through school, they're taught a certain pronunciation, like with spelling bees, we have to do things a certain way. But when we go out to a bar, we hang out with friends, we tend to use our own regional pronunciation. And when we do that, then we often get a lot of differences where people don't understand each other for certain words.
And are most people conscious that they're pronouncing things differently, or at least until they go somewhere else in the country?
There are some words that are marked out as what we call shibboleths. There are these words that are marked out that are very sort of highly, have a lot of consciousness to them. So like if you go out of the area and you say bag or bag, even stronger, then people know, oh, they're from the Midwest. Or if you use bubbler, something like that. But a lot of things don't happen at that level. So like some people will deny using certain words, but they do it all the time, like this anymore.
I knew I was a Wisconsinite. the first time I went, I was out of the state. I was in San Francisco. I was at a theater, and I said to the guy at the counter, "Do you guys have a bubbler?" And yeah, he gave me this look of baffling. Have you run into that, Gene, the bubbler incident?
I have run into the bubbler incident because I'm from western Wisconsin and bubbler is very prevalent there. But I've also run into it just saying Wisconsin because people will say, oh, you're from Wisconsin because of the way you say it, you draw it out. And it's one of those things that reminds me of the movie Fargo. If you recall, they had these wild accents from sort of northern Minnesota, North Dakota. And people in that part of the country when that movie came out were sort of offended. But if you listen to them, they actually sort of sounded like that.
Yeah, there's some reality to it. And I think part what's more important here is sort of the psychological reality of certain words. So there's a lot of things that people may or may not say from a certain area, but they'll use that marker because they know that's going to trigger something positive or negative.
Speaking of bubbler, I learned something in this. We are not the only state that calls it a bubbler.
Correct.
Who else does?
So over on the East Coast, there's a small area of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, and then also in Australia. And the reason for that, if you look at the maps, there's a really nice strip over by Lake Michigan. And it's because the Kohler Company marketed two different valves. I can't remember whether it was in the 20s or 30s or 40s. But one, it was a jet stream valve, and the other one was a bubbler valve. So you can see these around the Capitol. We have bubblers, true to Wisconsin, you know, identity. And then other places you find water fountains, drinking fountains.
Fun fact, one name that was up for contention for this show was the bubbler. So I guess that would have helped us capture that pivotal Rhode Island market if we'd gone that way.
That's right.
And we would have had a surprising internet presence in Australia, too, right. I think. You know, soda and pop is always an eternal discussion, and I'd forgotten until this came up that if you go in certain places in the South, you ask for a Coke, regardless of what you want to drink, if it's pop.
Correct. And that's a lot like the bubbler, because it's basically a product that's very localized in the same way that bubbler was a product that was localized. I think what most people are aware of Coke, but they're less aware of the bubbler. Mm-hmm. Fact.
One convenient word that I wish we would adopt from the South is y'all, because it fits. It fills a gap that we have in our language. If I say you, you don't know if I'm talking to you, our guest, or you, our listener. It's singular, plural. Y'all is more than one. Is it spreading? I hope it is.
Well, the most obvious one is also the most socially marked. So use is just putting a plural S on or Z on the end of the word. And that would be the most common. But it's also interesting because it's the most socially stigmatized version. So then we get you guys, which is almost like a double marking of the S plus guy. And then people say, oh, that's gender marked. We don't like it, but everybody is using that one now.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got a call. Becky from Verona joins us. Hi, Becky.
How are you?
I am great. How are you? You don't sound like you're from Wisconsin.
Well, here's the thing. I'm born in New Jersey, and then I lived there for 30 years. I lived in Kentucky for 10 years, and now I lived in Wisconsin for 14 years. So I've got a really mixed up accent. But one of the things I wanted to say was things are used so differently. Like, for instance, in New Jersey, a toboggan is a sled you go on in the snow. But in Kentucky, a toboggan's a ski hat. And in Kentucky, they see things like the roads tore up. And when you pick up your kids, you're packing them. I'm going to pack the kids to grandma's house. It just has, they have so many different ways of using words in Kentucky. And the one remnant I've had from New Jersey is I say daughter and quarter and dog.
Well, there you go. And thanks for all those lessons in regional pronunciations, Becky. And Tom Purnell, it's a reminder that for people who do move around a lot, or if you're visiting relatives or if you're traveling, sometimes you really got to think about what you're hearing.
That's correct. I moved around a lot as a child, and I identify with upstate New York, but a lot of things that I have, one or two vowels may come from Pennsylvania where I lived or California. And I think a lot of people now in the sort of mobile like, you know, we're moving around a lot more, tend to have this where they have a little bit of here, a little bit of there. And that's actually making for sort of a nice sort of quilt of language throughout the country.
Now, if I go to a custard shop and order a caramel sundae, well, obviously I've ordered custards. So that's a giveaway that I'm from Wisconsin there. But does saying caramel instead of caramel have a regional twist to it?
It does. We have actually arguments in our family, immediate family, about this, also with the word crayon and crown, sort of the different variants there with that. But part of that is we don't really when you're actually in a speech setting, you don't really have some of those differences pop up. So, for instance, you tend to just talk, and in the context of a sentence, some of the pronunciations don't really mean make a difference in terms of understanding, but they do make a difference in terms of marking you out and saying, okay, I know where that person's from. Either I'm like them or not like them. And then we tend to form those bonds. It reinforces social boundaries by knowing that information.
And I've been in situations where if I want to be accepted in a group, I kind of turn it on, if you know what I mean. I mean, all mm-hmm. of a sudden I develop the regional stuff. And so it can be a conscious thing too. It's not always just this subconscious, I've lived here for a long time and it just happens.
That's correct. In fact, the three of us who work in the Wisconsin Englishes Project at the UW, Joe Solomon's in German, Eric Ramey and myself, none of us are from Wisconsin, but we've all adopted many things to show that we accept and we want to be part of this group.
So do that for us now. Rob's from Michigan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm the only Wisconsinite here.
Right.
But so prove you want to be part of the gang here.
My choice is between drinking soda or going to the bubbler. I'm not that conscious of it, I don't think, though. And it's not like I go back to Michigan and suddenly I'm talking like the other people from Michigan. But some people really kind of code switch, right? Mm-hmm.
They do code switch a lot. My wife is from Virginia and she went to college in Pennsylvania. And very quickly, through all the teasing, she had to stop sounding like a Virginian and learn how to go back and forth. So when she went home, she didn't sound like she was from Pennsylvania.
So is this a field that is ever changing? I mean, you talk about some of the words, and they're relatively recent in origin. I imagine new things are popping up and disappearing all the time.
Yeah, words actually are more like clothing, where the styles really matter. The pronunciation and even some of the grammatical structures, that tends to change more slowly. But the words themselves are very sort of transitory. They come and they go. And very few words like cool stick around for a very long time.
You mentioned earlier that there's some, you know, some things are getting the same in part because of mass media and things like that. Do you have an opinion? Do you want to see more of these variations? Do you want to see them stick around in the future?
Well, variation is my job. So
the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. But I think the one thing I study is how identity is reflected through someone's speech. And so I think it's very important. And when you think just in terms of population numbers, the more people you have, the greater the number of subgroups you're going to have. The more subgroups you have, the more types of ways of identifying people there will be. And one of the ways that you can identify groups like that will be through language.
All right. Well, Tom Purnell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tom Purnell, an associate professor of English at the UW-Madison.
So any other words that get you into trouble, Gene, when you go abroad to foreign states?
Not so much, although Purcell is an Irish name. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Ireland, it's definitely Purcell.
Purcell.
And it can be Purcell in certain parts of the United States as well. And so people can spot where you're from. And in Wisconsin, it's Purcell.
And, of course, you order that brandy old-fashioned sweet in a bar anywhere else in the country, and they'll know you're from Wisconsin,
exactly
too.
Exactly so.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk about baseball. Here in Wisconsin, the Northwoods League, a big thing in a lot of communities, a lot of history in that, too. And then we'll also talk about scoring games by hand. Is it a dying art? I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.